I call the meeting of the House Water Division to order. A quorum is present. Members, please take your seats. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Heitzman, if you had a chance to look at the minutes.
I did, Mr. Chair. I think we should go ahead and move those. They look good.
Okay, thank you. Representative Heitzman moves approval of the minutes from January 28th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion is approved. First item on most of our agenda today is going to be presentations that we have. Our first series of presentations is going to be an overview on soil and water conservation districts. We will have, starting off, if I'm reading our agenda correctly, will be Ms. Leanne Buck, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. If you'd like to come forward and then introduce yourself and start the presentation. And thank you for being here today. Appreciate it.
Members, thank you. So again, good morning. My name is Leanne Buck, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts.
There we go, talking to the mic. In 1937, basically, talk about the history, and I'm going to go through this really quickly and then defer to a couple of our resource professionals here that tells you what really happens on the landscape. So in 1937, President Roosevelt sent a statute, a template, to each of the governors and the legislatures across the country. And in Minnesota, we adopted the legislation in 1937, and that triggered the creation of the first soil and water district in 1938. So we're celebrating 80 years. Minnesota soil and water districts, our duties and responsibilities are under the Minnesota Statute 103C. We are a legal subdivision of the state of Minnesota. There are 88 soil and water districts in Minnesota. In general, I'm not going to go through all the details of that statutory requirement, but in a nutshell, it's focused on private lands conservation. We look at voluntary incentive programs, and we look at conservation education opportunities. Each soil and water district is governed by locally elected officials or local board members. They have 5 soil and water supervisors. We have resource professional staff housed in each of the soil and water district offices. And here's the most important piece, what we do. Every single day we work with landowners across the state of Minnesota. And so what we're doing is we're implementing those conservation practices, or our terminology is best management practices, BMPs. And it could be sediment basins, watershed, different activities. But again, ultimately, those activities that we're working with on behalf of the landowners and with the landowners are usually done through voluntary incentive programs. And I just want to remind people that if they are doing these practices, it's usually done with cost share. So the landowner, just as much as the public and the money that you appropriated, they're sharing in the cost of those practices. What we don't have in our statute, we do not have land use authority, the planning and zoning components, and we do not have taxing authority. Our funding sources are primarily from county, state, and self-generated funds. And I also want to acknowledge the federal government. Out of our 88 soil and water districts, approximately 70 are co-located in USDA field offices. And why USDA field offices? It goes back to our early statute that triggered that connection with the federal government. We're very much affiliated with different farm bill programs. And again, the leveraging and the technology and some of the technical aspects of the federal government, we share in that, and we also are able to leverage. So our primary partners at soil and water districts, I'm going to keep repeating this, is the landowners themselves across the state of Minnesota. But we do work very closely with county government, watershed districts, cities. Our primary state agency, although we work with a ton of state agencies, the primary one is the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. There's a lot of grants that come through. There's accounting, the accountability, the reporting, the projects targeted and measurement type of components. Again, that feedback goes back to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we also work with our USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. And I just want to acknowledge, too, that although we are looking at the work that the districts do, there is an economic impact across the state. The landowners, they are putting money into these projects as well as the state. and local, and that leverages, in Minnesota, it does have an economic input. It could be hiring contractors, seeds, pollinator, different materials for those conservation practices. And in 2017, we did a partnership with Bowser and the NRCS, the USDA partner, and what we did see is that for the state, we are leveraging about 1.352 every dollar that the soil and water districts contribute. So again, this goes throughout the state of Minnesota and all of those 88 soil and water districts. So in a nutshell, the way I look at it, it's our bumper sticker statement that we work with. It's helping people help the lands. And again, we have a voluntary focus for those individual BMPs. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Jay Riggs with the Washington Conservation District to talk about from a metro perspective. Jay?
Thank you, Leanne. Take 2 seconds here. I lost it. Thank you. There we go. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. As Leanne said, my name is Jay Riggs. I'm the district manager of the Washington Conservation District. Hello. I'm very honored to be here and talk to you about the fine work that the Metropolitan Soil and Water Conservation Districts work on. When I say Metro SWCDs, I'm typically referring to the 11-county metropolitan area because that is our technical service area, and we work with all 11 of those SWCDs quite frequently. Obviously, there are different concentrations of metropolitan areas in these different counties, but we do work very closely together on a number of initiatives. Washington Conservation District is a soil and water conservation district. We changed our name to shorten it about 15 years ago or so. We have an elected board of supervisors who don't wear as many hats as they used to, one of whom is here today, Jim Levitt. Wanted to recognize. Thank you for coming here today. And our mission at the Conservation District is to enhance, protect, and preserve the natural resources of Washington County through conservation projects, technical assistance, and educational resources to citizens and local government. And that's going to be a theme. Everything that we do at the Washington Conservation District is a collaboration. It's a collaboration with landowners. It's a collaboration with our funding partners. Leanne listed a number of funding sources for SWCDs. Our funding formula is 20% from the county, 20% from the state, and 60% through local agreements with primarily watershed organizations. And under those partnership agreements, we do a lot of work. Not all of this is done in Washington, but most of these things are done in Washington, and this is talking about what we're doing throughout the metropolitan area. But primarily, we're collaborating with landowners and local units of government to implement conservation practices. We're providing administrative support for not just the SWCDs, but also watersheds. For example, two of the watershed organizations in Washington County are co-located with us and technically are employees of the Conservation District, so we have a shared staffing system with the watersheds, Browns Creek and Middle St. Croix Watershed. We do strategic and watershed-based planning. Not all of the state obviously has watershed organizations, and where there aren't, the SWCDs are oftentimes taking a lead doing that. We are doing prioritizing and targeting of implementation. We're working at implementing monitoring programs, education and outreach, urban and rural conservation technical assistance, habitat enhancement and management, land protection, conservation practice maintenance, which is a new program that we have in Washington that we've been doing for the last couple of years now. We work with EIS and the county, and we also implement the Wetland Conservation Act. So we're doing a wide variety of activities. I'm going to give a few examples of each of these things and try to get through this presentation rapidly. We're monitoring lake streams and stormwater. So in Washington County, we have approximately 50 continuous stream monitoring stations. After every storm event, we go out and collect water samples at these streams. So if you're ever going through Washington County and you see one of those large green metal boxes, with a solar panel next to it. That's our monitoring station. And we also monitor about 50 to 60 lakes per year. We have a lot of lakes in Washington County. We care a lot about the water quality. And so we go out every 2 weeks to each one of those lakes. So we're collecting water samples and sending it off to the lab. So we monitor also stormwater. And all this, most of the monitoring that we're doing, the vast majority is actually funded through the collaboration with the watershed organizations. So we're working with them as sort of a shared staffing program to do all the monitoring throughout the county. It's one of the most progressive and thorough water monitoring programs in the state, for sure. So we're doing science to help us identify what's happening with our water resources, but to also make better decisions on implementing conservation practices. For prioritizing and targeting, we are implementing some watershed analyses where we're going out and we're modeling the areas to identify where we should be implementing practices and identifying the different types of practices that we can install, but also recognizing the important piece of doing field work. Modeling can only do so much, and to really identify where practices should be prioritized and targeted on the ground, you actually have to get on the ground. And so we are doing that field work to help identify and prioritize where we should be installing these practices to get the biggest bang for the buck, so we can then have measurable impacts and benefits to our receiving waters. And we're seeing those benefits in a number of areas. We're doing a number of other assessments to identify and prioritize where we're implementing practices. This is actually a preliminary assessment for a project on Goose Lake in northern Washington County, where there was a large drainage area draining down to a wetland, and we're able to enhance, in partnership with the Canadian Marine St. Croix watershed, a treatment practice that's going to help delist that water body. Okay. There are a couple of waters actually in Washington County that we're anticipating being able to delist in the near future. We have a very innovative education program in Washington County. This is a collaboration between 22 local units of government. We work with the county, the conservation district, all the watersheds, and a number of cities to help them implement their stormwater education requirements. So we're helping all of them meet their plans and goals, and also more effectively implementing this outreach and education campaigns. So if you are in Washington County, you get any of the local papers, you're going to read articles by Angie Hong. She works for the East Metro Water Resource Education Program. That program is out of our office. We're also working with high schoolers through a volunteer stream monitoring program. We actually collect good data in addition to working with some highly motivated future employees, I hope. By the way, if any of you have any college age or recently graduated children, we're hiring. We have probably about 10 spots available for AIS inspectors. And so keep that in mind, mnwcd.org. And a core part of the work that we do at any conservation district is working with landowners. We do one-on-one landowner support, and we have a one-stop shop where we're able to meet with we do the science to identify where to do practices, and then we meet with the landowners to actually come up with concepts and then work with them through the design process, leveraging financial aid and the technical assistance, which is critical. In some areas, we do larger scale workshops to bring multiple landowners in at once, but it really comes down to that one-on-one conversation and relationship with the landowners to be able to get the practices in the ground. Washington County does still have a significant land area that's agricultural. We have about 25% of our land is still in crop production or pasture, and so it's very important for us to work with our farmers. And just Saturday, we actually had a workshop up in Scandia where we had 43 farmers in attendance to help identify implementation of practices. We work very closely with the Extension and other partners to implement education for elected officials. We like to go out to the fair. So the Washington County Fair is one of those really awesome events for us to reach out to landowners and get information out to folks. We do a lot of presentations for schools. We do collaborate very closely with the private sector. I did not get permission from either of these gentlemen to get their photos up here, but conveniently their faces were hidden. It seems to happen a lot in my photos. where folks hide behind trees or my employees, working with contractors to install large projects. Here's an example of a grass waterway, kind of a traditional agricultural practice that's treating runoff from the farm fields. But this is done in this specific circumstance to provide a substantial load reduction of both phosphorus and sediment to the St. Croix River, which is a wild and scenic river. We're working with farmers on innovative practices and cover crops and other alternative practices to improve water quality to not just address sediment, but also the soluble phosphorus uptake. And lots of these practices then, too, have a significant benefit on groundwater protection, where we're enhancing infiltration and reducing nitrogen that's going down into groundwater. We're working on some very innovative stormwater management practices during construction, post-construction monitoring, but we're also involved in some very large stormwater management practices. This is an iron sand filter system that was installed in Anoka Conservation District. We do shoreline projects on small lakes and big rivers. We manage habitat. We like doing burns. We're very active in doing prairie establishment in Washington County. We've done a lot of acres of conversion of high-maintenance turf that can have a substantial water quality impact, and converting that to prairie, which dramatically reduces the amount of runoff, but also obviously enhances a lot of habitat. Trying innovative approaches that have mutually beneficial collaborations for doing invasive species management. We're tracking and maintaining our practices. We have multiple agreements with local units of government to actually do maintenance now, which is an important component of any program that involves installation of practices. And a lot of our cities are finding that some maintenance is a little bit beyond their expertise. And so we hire a seasonal person to help support, like a parks person going out and doing weeding in rain gardens. And so we're doing that extensively in Washington County. And we also try to be able to know where those practices are. We have mapping of where all the practices are and their status. I mentioned AIS. We're working closely with our county to hire seasonal employees to do inspections at boat launches. We're working to implement the Wetland Conservation Act. I'm a half-time manager, half-time WACA guy. So if you have any wetland questions in Washington County, give me a call. Working with diverse landowners to do beautiful projects, and this I'm just wrapping it up now, okay, in both urban and rural landscapes. And the ultimate goal of this, in addition to working with landowners to do this, really is about resource protection. And we are a bunch of highly enthusiastic conservationists working to do just that. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. And what I'd like to do now is we'll segue to Holly, and then if it's okay, then we'll open up for questions.
That sounds good. Holly would like to go ahead and introduce herself.
Yes. We have Holly Kavorek with the Pope SWCD, and she'll be looking at it from more of a rural perspective in greater Minnesota.
Good morning. So I'm Holly Kavorek. I'm the district manager from the Pope Soil and Water Conservation District, and we're in west central Minnesota, approximately 150 miles west of Minneapolis or St. Paul. We're a very rural community and county. We have about 9 cities, of which the largest is the city of Glenwood, and I think we have about 2,500 population, so a little different than the Washington Conservation District. We have 3 major watersheds that we work with, the North Fork of the Crow Watershed, the Sauk River Watershed, and the Chippewa River Watersheds. And like I mentioned, agriculture is a predominant use in our county. We have a varied terrain in our county. We have a lot of steep, hilly terrain through the middle part of our county. The eastern half is heavily irrigated, so it's very diverse if you go from east to west across our county. So that means a varied number of types of practices that we're working with landowners on. We have a board of elected supervisors that oversee the district. Our mission at the Soil and Water District is conservation, protection, and enhancement of Polk County's natural resources. And we have been providing quality conservation resources since 1949. And we are co-located with our USDA partners, Farm Service Agency, and the Natural Resource Conservation Service. Our staff also has to maintain a variety of certifications in order to do the work that we do. We have what we call job approval authority for the different practices that we have to maintain. So we're continually keeping those certifications up to date so that we can do the conservation practices and assist the landowners in those technical needs. We also have a variety of programs, much like Jay mentioned in their district. We do a lot of Conservation Reserve Program, the Reinvest in Minnesota Program, the Wetland Reserve Program, Environmental Quality Incentive Program, walk-in access, shoreline, buffers, erosion, and sediment control. And then we also have a very strong cooperative weed management program in which we are managing invasive species, specifically wild parsnip, in our county. And we also have three staff that maintain a pesticide applicator licenses because they're working with that cooperative weed management program. A variety of things that we do, kind of the picture in the backdrop is a picture of the Dust Bowl from the 1930s. That's why we exist, and we work on conservation practices, everything from groundwater quality quantity, erosion control, flood prevention, water conservation use. We also manage the Wetland Conservation Act out of our office. Forest land protection, even though Polk County is kind of considered the prairie pothole region of the state, we still do have shelter belts and other tree plantings that we're doing. Non-point source pollution, wildlife habitat, and then we do have a strong education program. I like to use this slide. I've used this in a variety of presentations over the time that I've been with the district. Tourism is very important to Polk County. We have 200 plus lakes in our county. We have a lot of people that come to our community to recreate. So tourism is vitally important. So the water quality of our surface waters is important, as well as our groundwater quality. Agriculture, again, is very important. And then we also have a lot of hunting. People come to our community to hunt and fish and recreate. And then also, all these pictures are of spouses or children of our employees. Our future, they are our future, and it is important that we leave the land better for them, and that will be important as well. And so this is great work that we do, and leaving this better for future generations. So we focus our work based on our local water plan, whether it's a one watershed, one plan, or a county water plan. We're kind of in that transition phase right now in our county. We have two one watershed, one plans in process, and then we have our local county water plan. Our main priorities for implementation are surface water quality, erosion and sediment control, surface water management, and groundwater quality and quantity. And at the heart of the plan is the impaired waters that we have in the county. We have an 8-lake TMDL study that was conducted, and that's kind of the heart and kind of the meat and potatoes of our plan. And that's informing where we focus and prioritize and do our work. Here's just a varied pictures of education programming, everything from youth programs to some of the adult education that we do. The bottom corner there's a picture at our Roche Holt Field Day. We actually own a research facility and partner with other soil and water districts in doing water quality monitoring. Drinking water protection, we do have a well sealing program that's pretty popular. We work with landowners to seal abandoned wells. And we also host an irrigation clinic for producers to manage their irrigation water as to learn different tools and resources that are available to them so that they can improve the way that they irrigate and as well as protect that quantity of the groundwater resource. We are also in the Bonanza Valley Groundwater Management Area. We have erosion control types of practices we do. These are the kinds of things when somebody calls, we go out and we see in the field. Erosion. We have water quality types of projects. This is actually a project on Lake Minnewaska. We had flooding, but there was also, you can see the water is very turbid, water quality concerns on Lake Minnewaska. We're prioritizing our work not at the not only at the sub-watershed, but within the field and putting the BMPs on the landscape where it makes sense. We use models as well, and you can see the color coding here in the backdrop. That's a model that we have done to analyze the sub-watersheds, where should we work first. And so everything that's in the orange and the yellow are kind of our highest priority areas to implement projects. We've been doing them in a treatment chain fashion. In this particular sub-watershed, there were 17 BMPs that were implemented. And up in the corner, you can see that picture that I used of the water quality coming into the lake. That's where that point was. Had been a long-term resource concern on Lake Minnewaska. They actually, the county had to dredge the lake there because so much had been pushed out into the lake. And we have now since remedied that issue. It took a couple years and multiple grants, but we eventually partnered with multiple landowners, our Natural Resource Conservation Service, and were able to get all of these implemented. Here's another example of a sub-watershed project. Again, the same type of concept, working in a treatment chain fashion, multiple landowners. In this case, there were four different property owners that we had to coordinate with. You can see at the bottom there, the inset picture, that was actually the outlet where it came into the lake, and it had been blowing out into the lake again. And so we've since implemented those series of BMPs. Here's another example. This one actually outlets into Outlet Creek. And you can see the creek off on the side of the picture here. This project is actually currently in process. The stuff up on the far corner, we actually implemented this past fall. And then the rest of this year, as we move towards the river, will be implemented sometime this year in 2019. And I think there's three landowners that we're working with on that particular project. We have a lot of interest in the Conservation Reserve Program in our county. We do alternative tile intakes. We have a lot of animal agriculture in our county, so we're doing programs with those producers, cover crops. We actually have a lot of grazing management plans and systems, and then crop residue management. Like I mentioned, we do a lot of water and sediment control basins because of our topography. This particular picture shows one of our structures on ag land, a wetland creation that we worked with a producer on, and in the backdrop you can see how close Lake Minnewaska is. Lake Minnewaska is the 13th largest lake in the state and definitely a tourist attraction for Pope County. Here's a close-up of that line waterway that I showed you earlier on the previous slide. We do shoreline restoration projects. Here's a before and after. Here's another picture of a project in the Lake Emily watershed project area. This particular project, you can see Lake Minnewaska is upstream. We have Lake Emily downstream. And there's a series of BMPs that we worked with this producer to implement, all to improve water quality within that watershed. Although we are predominantly rural and ag is our predominant focus, we also have municipalities in the city of Glenwood. We are doing something similar. We worked with the city to analyze all their culverts and conveyances within the city to implement practices within the city. They have a lot of eroding ravines, and here's some examples of what those ravines look like. And so we're working right now to implement practices within the city to help them address this, which will help Lake Minnewaska, which is downstream. This is just a breakdown from our 2017 financials. We leverage a tremendous amount of federal funding through the programs we help administer, predominantly the Conservation Reserve Program. We employ a full-time Farm Bill technician, and she is responsible for working with those producers to implement those programs. We have about 21,000 acres that are in the CRP program within our county. That equates to about $1.9 million in payments that go to landowners for that annually. And that is important also to our economy as well as these other programs and community, because that goes back into the local economy. Here's just a little different representation of the breakdown of how of our funding sources work, the local, the county, and then state. This graphic just shows representing for our county appropriation, for every dollar that our county provides to us, we're leveraging $33 more federal, state, and local per dollar of county. Here's just another example of our financial statements. We're about 18% county, 12% local, 70% state, of which some of that state funding is our grants that we have to competitively apply for. And it does vary from year to year. Our implementation team, we have a variety of people that we're working with and coordinating with. We have some shared services types of agreements with some of our neighboring soil and water districts. Our engineering services are actually out of the Stearns Soil and Water Conservation District, as well as Stevens. We work with three different watershed organizations. Partnerships are vitally important to the work that we do. And most importantly, we work with the producers, and they are our local connection to the land assisting. We are the local connection to the land assisting property owners. And each of one of these pictures represents producers that we've worked with, and actually this is through the certification program, the Minnesota Department of Ag's Water Quality Certification Program. And a lot of these producers have also implemented additional VMPs. As they went through those programs. So thank you, and if you have any questions.
All right, thank you for the presentations. At this point, we've got a couple of minutes for questions that anyone may have. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
We know that county participation varies across the state. Do we have an idea? Is that on the increase or the decline in general?
In general, I think it's approximately, I would say, static. We have one county that does not provide funding, but they do provide a rent for the district. And then on the flip side, probably our largest allocation from county is with the Stearns SWCD. So in between, we have had state funds that have been coming in, and we did look at that as also making sure that we had a matching program from the county. So again, we're about stable with the funding that the county is providing.
Okay, thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, any idea what percentage of the overall, if we look at it as statewide, what percentage would the counties be contributing?
Off the top of my head, I can get you the more detailed numbers. I think we're approximately, for the operational side, it's kind of challenging because the majority of the money that do flow through the soil and water districts, there's a large amount of project dollars. But if we look at the operational, I would say budget-wise, the districts come in about half, or county provisions come in about half of the funds for the state that the districts operate with.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Torkelson. Next, I believe I've got Representative Sandell. Did you have some questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the USDA and your relationship. I know that the Farm Bill, the U.S. Farm Bill, it has an enormous impact on soil conservation and natural resources. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and maybe just invite me to have a longer conversation with you about that relationship?
Ms. Buck?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Sandell. Yes, soil water conservation districts, the federal farm bill programs are very important to the landscape that's utilized. So the soil and water districts, I would say, but for the soil and water districts, you have those local citizen boards. They are, you know, what started the conservation imprint of the federal farm bill. They were, early on, they were only to be in the county as long as there was a soil and water district there. So our soil and water district board helps identify priorities. We work very closely, and it's a give and take. And Holly also works. But, yes, I'd love to follow up. The Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, is a tremendous program. We're providing a lot of assistance with that. And I think Minnesota is one of the largest states to receive allocations from the federal government through the USDA program. And part of that reason is because there are soil and water districts in Minnesota that are keeping those monies in the state. They're keeping them in the counties, and we're helping to leverage those dollars.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, and then next I have Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I guess an observation and then maybe an ask to whoever can answer my ask. The observation that I've experienced is in northern Minnesota, there's such a patchwork of the funding, and kind of explain some of that too. And it comes down to some inefficiencies within the system. I've been approached by SWDC board members about cleaning up the language for health care for the employees. So could you tell me how many employees are, how many SWDC employees are there statewide? Is there a way to do this more efficiently as far as providing wages and benefits for the employees?
Ms. Buck.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, one of the challenges is our association does have an initiative where we're looking at kind of the way we approach conservation. Being a subdivision of the state, we're looking at kind of shared responsibility between state and county government. You have identified a key issue, the patchwork approach. Each district has their local autonomy. Each district is beholden to somebody else to provide their operational funding. So we, again, have disparaging levels of this just solid or sustainable funding for the soil and water districts. Regarding health care, it is up to each district as we acknowledge that local autonomy that each district has for those decisions. Some have partnered with their counties. Some have partnered on their own. They're trying to find those benefits. And maybe Holly or Jay, I don't know if there's any thing that you would like to add, but it is challenging on all sense of looking at how do we sustain qualified individuals so that they stay in their jobs, in their careers with soil and water districts.
We used to be on the public employee insurance program, but it was cost prohibitive for our staff. There's four of us. And so we did go to a stipend, which is taxed, that gets added into the paycheck of the employee. And then they are either out on the open market getting insurance or have health insurance through through like a spouse's employer is how our program works in our district. You know, maybe not the best scenario, but that's what has worked for us here most recently.
Representative Sundin, any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I guess, another statement. I'd like to see, you know, a proposal for more efficiency statewide from your state organization rather than having a whole bunch of stepchildren all over the state to get their act together. Wouldn't be a bad thing. A few years back, I can't even remember what committee we were in, we saw mapping of pesticides and nitrates in the flowing into the Great River or the Red River of the North, and I was just shocked some of the pesticides and the nitrates flowing north there. And it's just a wonder that Canada hasn't declared war on us for what we're doing. I'm just wondering if we could get an update on those maps. I know there's been a lot of work statewide with agriculture as far as application of pesticides and fertilizers. I'm just wondering if we can see some benchmarks from where we were, where we are, and where the SWDCs think we're going.
Ms. Buck?
Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative, we work with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts as well as the Watershed District, so when you're looking at a larger basin scale and the state agency, we could see what that data is and provide you with additional information. The Board of Water and Soil Resources collects quite a bit of the data of kind of the aggregate of those individual activities that we are seeing. But we do see a lot of projects that are targeted.
Representative Sundin,
thank you, Mr.
Questions.
Chair. Looking forward to seeing some of that data.
Okay, very good. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick clarification. I don't think that the Soil and Water Conservation Districts have any stepchildren per se, but I think there are differences. There's in some places a lot more soil, and in places like my district, a lot more water. So there's going to be a wide range of activities and efforts across the state, I'm sure. That they're all working with the challenges that each individual soil and water conservation district's area may have. And I think that working on the issue relative to having some continuity between insurances and so on and so forth, that does make sense, Representative Sundin. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. And then one quick question I have for our testifiers is, I know you weren't able to go into a lot of the issues, but one that kind of intrigued me a little bit was you were talking about creating wetlands and holding water back. What are some of the things that you've been doing, and are these things that you're, when you're holding the water back, creating these wetlands, are these for temporary holding the water on the land, permanent, or is it a combination? And who would like to take that? If you could identify yourself.
Yeah, Holly Kaborik. So that particular project was temporarily, there would be some water held there at a certain pool elevation, but it was mainly for capturing that water in a storm event. So it would function much like, so in a actual storm event, it would hold that water for a 24-hour, that bounce that mm-hmm. would be in the structure would be for like a 24-hour time frame, and then it would go back down. So I think that answers the question.
Ms. Buck?
Thank you. Just to add to it is, as a state level, soil and water conservation districts do quite a bit of wetland restoration work, and we've been doing that through the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. So see, Holly was talking about the Federal Farm Bill, CRP. We leverage that with the state's Room Reserve Program, usually through the Bonding Committee and capital improvement projects that way. Our next speakers, they'll talk about some larger storage activities. But then I would also say we're looking at everything from that individual landowner. It could be soil health initiatives, so there's more absorbency in the soil and healthier soil capacity. You can have it at different scales with sediment control basins and holding that back, and then you can have it for larger wetland restorations.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. I appreciate once again you folks taking the time to be here today and answer our questions. And with that, we will move on to the next part of our. Oops. Anything you'd like to add, Ms.
Video, and maybe this just really shows the diversity of the state and some of the activities, and it does highlight that wetland sure. restoration. So if we could just take a moment.
Sure.
Minnesotans take great pride in the precious natural resources our state has to offer, but we're not all conservation experts. That's where soil and water conservation districts come in. Commonly known as SWCDs, these elected local units of government collaborate with landowners each day to help protect our land and water. From our farms, forests, and cities to our beautiful lakes and rivers, SWCDs offer technical expertise to preserve Minnesota's natural resources for generations to come.
The great thing about soil and water conservation districts is that we partner with landowners, cities, government agencies, organizations that really have a desire to make local water quality better.
We are the interface, really, between local, state, and federal initiatives and the producer.
We can provide technical assistance and expertise and support throughout the entire process, whether it's a big project or whether we're working with a homeowner that wants to just put in a small rain garden in their front yard.
They have a team there that know what the best management practices are. They are passionate about these projects, and they're willing to, you know, look for creative solutions.
Looking at the plans and going through the preliminary stuff with them was as exciting to see what they could create here.
These guys can help me, and if they don't know a question, they know where to get the answer.
We want to really educate people on the importance of the partnerships and the successful work that's being done.
Several of us landowners were concerned about the increase in aquatic weeds and the decrease in water quality here on Agate Lake. So we contacted the Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation District. And over on the four properties, we planted over 8,400 native plants, seven rain gardens, and three berms. And also on all four properties, we did biologs and willow wattle to stabilize shoreline.
These projects collectively reduce the sediment and the phosphorus attached to that sediment enough to reduce algae production by 2,000 pounds a year.
I think that's the best thing, is for people to have testimonies and a physical thing they can see before and after, and this is what it looks like.
The zoo has a lot of impervious surfaces or areas of pavement where water is just running off. It's then entering storm drains and often entering ponds or wetlands untreated.
When the SWCD came in, they looked at this area and said, you know, we think that we can catch a large chunk of the water runoff before it actually enters into your storm sewer systems.
We created these rain garden basins.
It gave that water a place to go.
Helping water infiltrate, recharge our groundwater aquifers. They're also really great pollinator habitat.
You'll be seeing a lot of cover crop initiatives as part of this program. And that cover crop initiative protects the soil improves water quality, and also going to be a real benefit to the farmer economically.
All these cover crops have given me opportunity to really suppress weeds and increase my water infiltration, and I can really see like the regenerative side of what I'm doing. I really truthfully see my soil improving from what it was.
It's really a better understanding of the soil, so that the soil really leads you to higher levels of productivity.
It's pretty hard on wildlife in certain areas when there isn't any collection point. And this area was not premium farmland.
So we looked at this site as a potential to take it out of crop production, put it into a permanent easement, and restore the hydrology. We can take that surface water during a storm event and we can put it into the wetland and reduce damage to our lakes, rivers, and even communities.
This gave us an opportunity to remove all the dead balsams, to help eliminate the fire problem that creates, at the same time reintroduce other species of trees and protecting the river as well.
Because we are using public funds for these projects, we have implemented monitoring sites pre and post treatment so that we can compare the two and change our methods to provide the most benefit to the ecosystem and to the landscape that we can.
Their job is to conserve water and natural resources, so they're looking for the best solution because what's good for you as the homeowner also is good for the district as well as the county down the river.
Everything does exist in a community that is layered and reliant on the constituents and what we can do to make that better and preserve these resources for generations to come.
We never say no. We always want to figure out what we can do. It impacts all of us. That's why it's important. You might not be the farmer farming that land, you might not be the taxpayer in that county, but we're all upstream of somebody, and so it matters.
It's what you hand down to the next generation.
Everything I do is for our kids, and if I want to pass the farm on, I better take care of it. We can achieve a better goal together than we can apart. Open your eyes and take a look. You can make it work on your farm.
If everyone does a little bit, start in your own backyard 100 years from now, it'd be pretty cool.
Welcome. Thank you so much for your presentation. And with that, next we'll move on to the overview of the watershed districts, and I believe Ms. Javins will start us off here.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, for our presentation here. With me today, I have Mark Dene from the Capital Region Watershed District. You are actually in the Capital Region Watershed District right now, so that seemed appropriate to bring him. And then I also have Jerome Deal, who will be coming down. He is from the Bois de Soulis Watershed District, and after I give you a quick overview of what watershed districts are, they're going to show us some projects about how they keep water on the land in a metro versus a rural setting. We are an organization that represents watershed districts. There are 45 in the state of Minnesota, and as of a month or two ago, we also decided as a membership that water management organizations should be able to be voting members of our organization, and so that is we are rolling then into our organization as well. So in 1955, that is when the legislature decided to allow watershed districts to form with the Watershed Act. We are a special purpose unit of government formed by petition, either by citizens, counties, or cities. We do have regulatory authority. We can finance large projects in ways that the soil and water conservation districts cannot, and we can levy taxes unlike soil and water. In 1982, the Metro Surface Water Management Act came into place, and that said that every square foot of land in the metro had to be covered by a watershed management plan. I'll talk about that just in a little bit. There are 14 different reasons why a watershed district can be established. I just wrote down a few of them here that seem to be more the big reasons why one would be formed. Initially, it was for to prevent and minimizing damage from floods. The second one there, navigation. The Lower Minnesota River, they are watershed district. They are charged with keeping open a channel deep enough that barge traffic can move through. They used to just have to dredge sediment out of that river once every 5 years. They're currently doing twice a year. So that is, it's a big issue, a big problem, and that's what the watershed districts are doing. We're tackling large problems, large-scale problems across different jurisdictional boundaries. Drainage, a lot of work with drainage, protecting lake streams and wetlands, water quality or groundwater. Those are some of the reasons why there might be one established. Excuse me. Here are the non-metro watershed districts. The largest one here is Red Lake in northwest Minnesota. That's almost 6,000 square miles, 5,990. Here is the metro watershed districts. The smallest one there is number 11 in the northeast corner. That's the Carnelian Marine St. Croix, and they only have 43 square miles. The WMO, so this was without Water Management Act, they need to be covered by a plan. The areas in gray, those are covered by county government. They watch over the water resources there. The ones in blue are the watershed districts, and then the pink are the a joint powers agreement. And so those are made up of either of the cities and townships. So their boards are appointed by the cities and municipalities. The watershed district boards are appointed by the counties. So theirs are not elected officials, they are appointed. WMOs are a little bit different. They don't necessarily have taxing authority unless it's stated in their JPA. And most of their funding comes through through their members. And those are not, those were mandatory. The WMOs are mandatory. A watershed district is always is a voluntary decision. Just throwing up here quickly, I don't typically put this many words on a slide, but since you have handouts, I wanted them to be a reference also. But this in statute, this was the general purpose, to conserve natural resources and bring an attention here using the sound scientific principles to protect public health and welfare. We have some powers that you probably don't realize. We can sue and be sued. We can incur debt. We have eminent domain, which is not used very often. And then the funding issues and be able to perform acts just to make sure we can get our work done. And some of the specific powers, I'm just pulling out a few of them just to give you a flavor of what we can do. On the left there is the ditch and water course work, a lot of work on drainage. And then also we can build dams, dikes, reservoirs, and own and operate those, and we do. We can own land and have projects, like I said. We can even own land in other states. We're allowed to do that if that is of benefit to the watershed. We are required to have rules. We have to have rules and a permitting system to make sure that we can achieve what we need to get done. And a couple of, I grabbed a couple of them, water use and conservation, we may regulate that. And metropolitan watershed districts can regulate the use and development of land. And lastly, we are covered by plans. There's a lot of different ways that that can happen. Not going to get into that, but either in 103D or 103B, we are required to do that. And I want to turn that then over to the water statistics so you can see what their plans are actually getting done on the land.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Javins. Mr. Dunay, go ahead and introduce yourself and start your testimony, please. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Mark Dunay. I'm the administrator with the Capital Region Watershed District. We are one of the smaller districts in the state of Minnesota. However, we are the most urban, most diverse, and have probably the higher tax base of the districts in the state. Our fully built-out watershed then provides challenges for us to find space to retain water in the land. Today, I just have three brief project stories to tell you about, to show you how we retain water in the land, we improve water quality, reduce flooding, we conserve potable water and recharge the groundwater. We work with our partners and we work with them to leverage local resources. We provide multiple benefits on our projects, as well as we started incorporating technology to save money and improve the efficiencies of our operations. The first project I want to talk about is the Como Senior High School project. So St. Paul Public Schools was doing a renovation and addition to Como High School. Because of our regulatory program, they came to us for a permit, and we started talking about the full scope and effect of the project and understood the football field would be torn up to put in a turf field. And we had discussions with them and then brought in the city of St. Paul and talked about why not treat the entire 15-acre watershed for the entire campus and do it once and for all, and not just the minor addition that they were doing. The land in the red line there is the watershed that all goes to Como Lake, which is just on the left or to the west of this property. So we worked in partnership with the city of St. Paul and St. Paul Public Schools to come up with a combined system for all of this land. It's the first time we've worked with those entities in the past, but not in one single project. So we worked with the city to secure approval to put a diversion structure in Rose Avenue and collect all that road runoff. All the water went to that structure from the school campus. We diverted it underground, under the football field then, and put the water in these long underground pipes. They're perforated. So this is how we retain water in a lot of our projects in Capital Region because of the high cost of land and the lack of availability. So we put 33 rows of 36-inch perforated pipe on a gravel bed to collect all the runoff from this 15-acre parcel in the school. Here you can see the track going around the football field. So all the water goes in these pipes, fills up the pipes, then the pipes weep out into the gravel base, and that gravel base has the water that then soaks back into the ground, cleaning the water and recharging our groundwater aquifer. What I think is really remarkable is how the three entities came together on this project. With the City of St. Paul, they approved the diversion structure. They agreed to maintain this structure for 30 years. That has a $48,000 value. That value and their cost contribution of $150,000 went to credits. So with our stormwater program, we have a crediting program where entities aren't able to physically treat stormwater because of high groundwater, bedrock, or contamination. They can use credits for that. So having reasonable and flexible rules to allow entities to involve credits for their projects has been really helpful. St. Paul Public Schools then built the structure on their property. They're going to be responsible for maintaining that. They contributed the amount equivalent to the regulatory requirement as additional funds as well for their needs and credits for their own use. And then the Watershed District provided the design fees. We also contributed. We established the crediting system to put this Common Sense project together. And then we also were kind of an insurance agent with the school district, so that if there was any damages, we would back up the project and help any repairs that would occur to the track or field. Well, finally, with this project, I think what's remarkable, too, is just the well balance of funding between the city, the school district, and the watershed district. So there were no state funds. This is all local funding that was leveraged for this project. Cost nearly $750,000. Again, no grant money, local money. We're leveraging city right-of-way, school soccer fields for treatment to help protect and clean up an impaired water like Como Lake nearby. Next project I want to talk about is Curtis Field. It's just east of the state fairgrounds. It's the pond kind of next to the big parking lot. So in the northern part of the picture is State Highway 51 or Snelling Avenue, and then Larpinder Avenue. So this watershed all drained to a landlocked pond. And this pond would frequently flood and flood out the local city park. There are park facilities here that were damaged and impacted by regular increasing intensity of rainfall. So we worked with the City of Falcon Heights to develop this underground infiltration system in their park area. Again, we can't put a pond on a park. It doesn't quite work. They have a hockey rink there in the wintertime. So, well, again, in our urban environment, we go underground a lot of times with our project. We have nearly 400 feet of 10-foot diameter, again, perforated pipe that collects the excess floodwaters and then soaks it back into the ground and recharges the groundwater. One exciting and unique element of this project is some technology we employed. It's called OptiRTC, or Optimized Real-Time Controller. So this pipe outlet system is connected to the internet, and it's watching weather forecasts. There's a 75% chance of a 1-inch rainfall or more. It opens a valve and lowers the pond 2 feet a day ahead of the storm. So we have an extra 2 feet of storage prior to the rain event. The water that's drained off, of course, then soaks into the ground and recharges the aquifer. Then when the storm comes, the pond refills, and we have that additional capacity. This is just the mathematics on that. I'll just basically say to build that equivalent volume, about 17,000 cubic feet, would have cost about $150,000. The technology was only $70,000, so we saved money and provided additional flood capacity. And finally,
Representative Heinzman, do you have a quick question to this?
Yeah, I think it should go real quick. Just curious if you have, in these systems, you've done a number of them, Is there any potential for capturing some irrigation value for, like, the football field, for example?
Mr. Renee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the next project, we do have an irrigation system that I'll talk about. And any place we have these systems, we're trying to incorporate irrigation wherever possible.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I jumped the gun.
That's all right, Mr. Heinzman. Mr. Renee, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Yeah, so again, this project, no state funding, just two local units of government leveraging their resources together, taking advantage of the space that we had, fully funded through the City of Falcon Heights and the Capital Region Watershed District. Last project I'll talk about is the Upper Villa project, and this one does incorporate some irrigation. Just in the very lower right corner is Lake McCarran's, and again, it's not always about cleaning up impaired waters. We also want to protect our clean lakes and rivers and not let them get impaired in the first place, because it costs a lot more money to clean up dirty lakes than to keep clean ones clean. So this project, we did receive some state grant funding, and we looked at a number of different sites around this project area. The epicenter is kind of County Road B and Dale in Roseville, if you're familiar with that area. So this is a schematic that shows how the system works. We put a diversion in a big storm sewer that drained 800 acres that was going straight to Lake McCarran's, and we diverted it into a large underground cistern. That cistern holds about 100,000 gallons of water. When the cistern fills up, it would overflow into it again, one of these underground infiltration systems. But on top of that, we built one of these optimized real-time controller that would drain the cistern down in advance of a storm event, so we could have the capacity in the cistern. We also added a pump system, and we irrigate the ball field with the cistern water. And, you know, the numbers are 99%, but it's essentially all of their irrigation needs for that field are used with this cistern system, and that's about on an inch of water per week. We can pretty much cover all their irrigation needs. That's just a photo of the irrigation tank under the infield of the softball field. This is the pipe system that gets the overflow for the cisterns, and just a screenshot of this optimized real-time controller system, again, that drains out the cistern in advance of a rainfall. And this is a big watershed, so a 100,000 gallon tank is quite easily filled when we do get a rain event. This is just a dashboard from our optimized real-time controller. On the right, you can see that the cistern is being drawn down in advance of a rain event and going into that infiltration gallery. This chart here just shows that in 2017, May through August, we diverted about 76% of all the flow into the cistern and into the infiltration system. So keeping about 75% of all that water on the land and recharging the aquifer and using it for irrigation. Lastly, I'll just show the getting cost breakout. We did get about half of the money from state grants, but the rest of the money was City of Roseville and the Capital Region Watershed District. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Denae. And then why don't we move on to next to Mr. Deal with his presentation, and then we can go into questions when he's done.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you to the committee for listening to my presentation on this. I'm out of the Boise Sioux Watershed District, and we're way west central Minnesota, and if the Red River Valley flood starts, we're the guys that start it. We're at the south end of the Red River Valley, so out there when we're in intensively ag land. I mean, it's 95% and better ag. And we come up with putting this North Ottawa project out on ag land. And you see a picture up here of what it looked like, that area, before we really started doing anything. It was underwater all the time. It was underwater in the June floods and everything. And, of course, there had been many owners trying to make this land work. And the watershed went ahead and purchased the core section out of that. And we decided to start working on a project. And that magnitude, the project didn't come without some problems as we're starting to put this together. That's a pretty large area of 3 square miles. And taking that out of the local tax base, it hurts the township the most, and they had a valid point. So we were at the legislature, And we worked out a payment in lieu process with the township, and that worked fantastic. The county, they could do it, but they have not asked for that payment in lieu because the increased value of the land around this project is way more than offset what they would have lost. So we, the project itself covers 3 square miles. We put all that water on that 3 square miles. We're intercepting 75 square miles of drainage. We run a 10-mile diversion ditch to pick that up and intercept that water. Now, what we want with that is everybody above that project, we want the best drainage in the world up there. We want the water in the project so we can manage it. And this is what we're starting to find out on this, because now we do have... We have the actual test. We have the monitoring. We have what's going on in that project. And as you can see by the last picture, there's one section of the land is devoted to a water cell that stays with water. The rest are divided for agricultural and environmental. And we try to keep agricultural in the unit. It's a local cell to try and keep ag there. And ag helps with the operating and maintenance of this project, because we don't have an assessment base for this. It's a self-supporting project. And that's kind of what we're going from, is keep as much ag in as we come and experiment with some cells in the environmental end of it. To do that, we put interior diking in, that we can adjust the water from any cell to any cell. And we can take farmland and flood it in the fall for migratory. We can, it just, the range of options is wide, and the range of options follow the weather. You know, there's going to be some years you may be dry and won't have anything out of it. But as we continue on with this, some of the things we started to realize is the Red River delivers 15% of the flow at the Canadian line of the river up there, and yet we're putting in 60% of the phosphorus. And there's issues with that, and we've tried to tackle that with this project the best we can. You can have phosphorus and nitrogen removal in a unit like this with cells, and you can have it both in the wetland areas, and you can have removal on farmland too. Farmland can actually remove nitrogen and phosphorus if you do the timing right of what you're doing. So, as started as a grand experiment, we tried to harvest some cattails out there. As a farmer, I've sprayed the heck out of them for years trying to kill them. Well, here we tried to capture, and it was not fun because we found out there's a very short window to harvest cattail. Otherwise, the seeds plug up your radiators and all your equipment and everything else. It gets to be a problem to harvest them. But as we move on, you can start to see some of the fabulous loads we were taking out, both in suspended solids and nitrogen. It was phenomenal. I never, ever, ever dreamed that this would be. We expected some because of the cell. We expected something. But... And this is all being done, this research is being done by NDSU, University of Minnesota. This place is just about turned into a research facility and what we can do with it. But it never forgets the primary function of flood control. No matter what you do inside, it's automatically designed. If the big event comes, that takes over. The flooding is going to take over. So this has been a wild experiment for us. From where we started, what we thought we were doing, this thing holds 16,000 acre feet of gated storage and 2,000 acre feet more, 18,000 acre foot. And with the amount of water we have in it, we can go into drawdowns and provide stream augmentation and flow throughout the season, you know, and improve the water quality of the stream flow. And when we get to the birds, the impoundment with the farmland, flooding farmland, what we're seeing in the migratory is absolutely unbelievable. I haven't seen that since I was a very little kid. And will literally have hundreds of thousands of geese out there in the migratory, both spring and fall. But we've also come across, in this project, the endangered species. We've got bird counts. The DNR is doing this. DNR is doing a fabulous job on this, watching the birds, taking check of what's there. And we have weekly observations of what's going on. And what I never realized building a project like this, that we would have people from New York or the Audubon Society come out to watch this and watch what's happening in themselves. So, as you can see, we're extremely, in our area, we're extremely proud of this. We just found another aspect. Emily didn't know this till I got down here. The DNR has just issued a permit for water appropriations out of this unit to a new 10,000 cow dairy facility. Is that they're going to put in their own ponds and draw water away from this that would normally have been floodwaters so we can alleviate the pressure on the groundwater supply. So this is what we're working on. This is what we have. We have the research. And what we have coming is we've got another project just like this with the land bought. It's bigger than this one. And I'm looking so forward to getting the next one going. This one here, this project is a refuge. We asked the farmers, what do you want? They wanted a refuge. They didn't want hunters around their place. So this is a refuge. The next one will be huntable because we got some Lesage Sam's money going in. But that's what we're doing in rural Minnesota, and we're darn proud of this, and some of the Senate committees and House committees have come out and observed this. And I would welcome anyone to come out and take a look at what's going on here. So, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your presentations. Thank you for taking the time to come down to meet with us today and educate you about the efforts that you're doing out on the landscapes. I'd like to be able to open up for questions now. I'm sure there'll be some people with questions. I'm wondering, Representative Torkelson, did you want to start off?
Seems like it's a bad habit, Mr. Chair.
Well, you ask good questions, sir. I think that's appropriate.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Deal, for your presentation. Could you talk a little bit about how you move water through this project? How do you get the water in? How do you move it between those cells?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson. The water comes in a collector ditch, and this ditch is massive. But it's one of the things when we first built it, the farmers had never seen a ditch that big. And of course, they liked it immediately. And we intercept 10 miles of drainage, and we move it into the big cell, into cell 3, our standard cell that holds water during the summer. And from there, it backflows into the other cells in a flood condition. But we also have dikes. All the dikes around this area all have culverts in them and gates. So we can move that water into any cell we wish. So it's basically a plumbing job of how we do it.
Representative Turtles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have to lift any of that water, or is it all just gravity fed?
Mr. Deal. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, it's all gravity-fed. There is no pumps out there.
Representative Torkelson.
I thought the Red River Valley was flat as a table.
Mr. Deal.
Chairman, Representative Torkelson, yes, the Red River Valley is as flat as a table. In fact, nobody believed there was a hole out there when we started this. But we bring water from a mile and a half to 2 miles away, that's at a higher elevation, and that's how we can store it here. It's totally a gravity thing. You would think there should be pumps, but there's not.
Great to hear. Thank you, Mr. Deal. Any further questions, Representative Torkelson? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is where you're going to see the difference between the farmer and the late guy. My question centers around the cattail that you mentioned. And I'm thinking we're going to have to probably talk offline because we are running out of time is what it looks like.
Well, I'll leave a little bit more time is because one of the things that we'll do is Mr. Stark's not going to be able to finish his presentation, so we'll just hold it over to the next meeting. But there's some good questions coming out here, and I want the committee to be able to have time with the folks doing the work on the ground to be able to get some of their questions answered.
Really appreciate that, Mr.
You're
Chair.
Welcome,
I thought we were out. So my question is specifically around the cattail issue. We have a lot of cattail up in my district. That's a Brainerd area. And we're always seeing a question mark come up because we're seeing a lot of an invasive species potential there with a narrow leaf cattail and its hybrid. So when you guys are doing this harvesting work, are you harvesting the wide leaf, or is this a hybrid or the invasive?
It's the wide leaf that we're harvesting. And that is being applied right back on the land. We use hay choppers, chop it up into trailers, take it right back out on adjoining land. So that's how we're pulling the nutrients out of there.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to envision a way to do that in places where they're working over water, but I don't know if there's a way to do that. I'm seeing a word that pops up here, and you maybe alluded to it, and I'm not completely familiar, green manure.
Mr. Deal.
Mr. Chair, wow, there's various types of green manure. There's the real stuff, and there's like, it can be silage or hay. It can all be called that when it's in its green stage and fermenting. That, you kind of call that green manure, and it's applied back to the ground. Like years ago, plowing down sweet clover, that was a form of green manure. You plowed it down to make the soil better. That's, you know, it isn't the really green stuff you step in.
Thank you, Mr. Deal, for that graphic. Representative Heintzman, any further questions? I have a couple questions, particularly on this last project here. Is you're mentioning that there's quite a bit of phosphorus that you're holding back. Are you finding that you're also finding a overall sediment load that you're holding back?
Yes.
What are the plans as you go down the road as that starts building up?
That will, Mr. Chairman, that's going to have to be an ongoing maintenance. That's why we're trying to keep money associated with this project through the farming. There will have to be some cleanups time to time and put back out on the land.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Deal. That's why I was wondering is if this would be something then that the farmers would be able to apply to their fields down the road. Yeah. Awesome. It sounds like a great way to work it. Does anyone have any further questions from the committee? Hearing none, I want to thank everyone once again for taking the time to come down to us today from the outer reaches of the state and from the local area, help educate us as to what we're doing out in the landscape. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Mr. Stark, if you'd like to come down to start your presentation. We were originally planning this was going to be about a half hour, so we've only have about 15 minutes left. So this is one of the things as we're going through. Any questions that the committee may have today, we'll go ahead and take today. And then whatever we don't finish on this presentation today, then we will bring forward to our meeting next week. And this is the presentation that Mr. Stark is doing on the Legislative Water Commission. I do want to let folks know that Representative Torkelson is one of the co-chairs of the commission. The other co-chair of the commission is Senator Wieger in the Senate.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about the Legislative Water Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I will try to adjust my presentation here and get you done in time. So, as we begin, I find that often when I give these talks, we need to spend a little bit of time talking about the Legislative Water Commission because maybe we haven't done the best job of putting it forward so that everyone knows about it. So I'll just spend a moment or so talking about the commission and what they do and then talk about our process of recommendations this year and where we are in that process. So the Legislative Water Commission has several responsibilities. It reviews important water documents that come to the attention of the commission members. It informs the rest of the legislature, and it puts forward recommendations for legislation. Thank you. So really the scope and purpose of the Legislative Water Commission is to review policy reports and recommendations that deal with water, to recommend legislation, to share information with the agencies, to coordinate with the agencies and groups like the LCCMR and the Clean Water Council, and then to coordinate those activities across those entities. A little bit about who's on the commission. This is a list of the members of the commission at this point. Representative Torkelson, Senator Wieger are the chairs. There are a couple of new members, Representative Lippert and Representative Brand, and in addition, Representative Heinzman is joining the commission. So congratulations, and thank you, and we look forward to working with you. So I mentioned that there are 13 recommendations that we're putting forward for legislation. Those recommendations have been endorsed by the commission, and I'll spend a little bit of time talking about how we got to that point and how that process has gone. So the pathway to those recommendations involves several things. It involved first having the commission look at a series of documents, reports, suggestions, recommendations that have been put forward by state agencies over many years, about since the passage of the Clean Water Act, in fact, and trying to synthesize the messages that were presented from those documents. Out of that process, the commission came up with about 100 recommendations, and those were not new. Those were things that had been suggested by the agencies, by the university, by not-for-profit organizations over that period of time. So we had 100 recommendations over the summer. We worked through a stakeholder process that involved five meetings, and we asked people to come in to review those recommendations and to give us feedback and to help us prioritize those. So that happened over the summer. Out of that process came a ranking of those recommendations to about 20 or so. We followed that up with a survey process to about 450 stakeholder members who receive our biweekly water updates. So we asked them, here are the recommendations, what do you think, please rank them. And we found really that the process, the stakeholder process, the recommendations from the commission members fell very well and closely in line with what we had done, what we found from this survey. So that was a good indication. So out of that then came these 13 recommendations. I'll say just a couple of words about each one of them, but again, they're based on suggestions made by agencies, by stakeholders, by people at the university over a number of years. We discussed those within the commission. We held these workshops. We followed it up with a survey. And then finally, the commission members reached consensus on those 13 recommendations that were put forward to the whole legislative body. So they are based on three main things: clean and sustainable drinking water for the future, protecting and improving our waters, and preparing for changes that are going to occur in the future. They represent statewide priorities. They're bipartisan in nature. They focus, I think, on incentives rather than regulations. They build on minor changes to really the good work that the agencies do here within the state. They represent relatively small budgetary impact. They focus on first steps and on pilot programs to try to move forward some of these projects and programs, which could lead to significant program enhancements within the agencies. And some of them require us and the legislative body in particular to think long term, because these are issues that are long term in nature. So again, there are 13 of them. I'll just say a couple of words about each one. The first one is expanding source water protection. So beyond domestic drinking water wells, source water protection needs to be afforded to private wells in sensitive aquifers and into rivers that provide drinking water to our population. And what's needed there is legislation for monitoring and protection measures over those aquifers. This might not be the best day to talk about why we use too much salt. But on the other hand, maybe it is. So if you look around, you may notice that a lot of salt has been applied today, probably more than we actually need for safety. So this recommendation deals with our overuse of de-icers and about a bill to train applicators and to provide limited liability protection for trained applicators. Water sustainability is number three. We need to provide clean and sustainable water for the future because adequate water is necessary for drinking and to support our lakes and streams. What we need to do really is to fund additional monitoring, assessment, and planning to ensure that sustainability. The next is increasing the Minnesota Department of Health's drinking water protection fee. The service water connection fee is used to ensure that the water that we drink is safe. The fees to support that have not been increased since the 70s and are not adequate to provide that protection, and that service fee needs to be increased in order to do that. The fifth one is water retention, keeping water on the land. We need to retain more water on the land before it runs off. We've heard about this today. Water retention improves agriculture and it improves our water quality, and a bill is needed to support the most important agricultural practices at the right places. Sixth one is inflow and infiltration. So we need to fix our leaking sewers. Leaking sewers increase treatment costs and impair our waters. And a bill is needed to allow those resources to be used by sanitary districts. The seventh is the Legislative Water Commission sunsets in July. So if that commission has value, we need to ensure that it continues beyond that sunset date. The eighth is healthy soil and healthy water. Healthy soil promotes soil health and water quality. It's important both for agriculture and for water, and we need to provide a planning mechanism and outreach mechanism through the university and the Board of Soil and Water to ensure that that takes place. The eighth is K through 12 water education. We need to increase our focus on water education in our schools because it really isn't adequate. And a bill is needed to connect teachers in a way with volunteers who are able to assist them. The tenth one is about preserving our lakes. lakes are a really important resource for us, and they're threatened in many ways. So we need to begin a consolidated plan and work among the agencies who work with lakes to develop a preservation plan as a very first step. The 11th is the peer review of water quality standards. Peer review of water quality changes is really important. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has a process to ensure that that happens through a commissioner's order, but that order needs to be really memorialized in legislation so that it will continue. The 12th is water infrastructure. I think as you all know, our water infrastructure, stormwater, drinking water, wastewater, is old, needs a great deal of attention, and we need to consolidate a process to support wastewater, drinking water entities, both financially and technically, and in training materials to ensure that our waters are safe. And the 13th one and last is planning for an uncertain future. This is one of the long-term efforts. We know that things are changing, that floods and droughts are becoming more frequent and more intense. They affect our infrastructure. You need only look at floods in the southeast, droughts throughout the state, flooding events in Lake Superior to understand that things are changing on the landscape. And we need direction through the EQB to begin a plan to prepare for mitigation and changes that are occurring. So I sped through that. So where are we in this process? Well, as I mentioned, the commission has endorsed these recommendations. We have bills in draft form prepared for those. We're in discussions with the commission members, with the agency staff, and the other organizations around the state to try to move these forward as bills. So I think given that, I nearly caught you up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stark. That was pretty quick there. I appreciate that.
I will say this, Mr. Chair, members, if I could. If you want to know a little more about these recommendations, I would refer you to this sheet, which has a little more information. If you want to know a little more, there is this memo that went out to the legislative body, which has at least a paragraph of detail. And then if you want to know more, there's a document backing each one of these up. So if you want to know more about any one of those, let me know, and I'd be happy to provide that for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. I appreciate the presentation there. The documents that are being referred to are in your packets, members. I would encourage you to hang on to them. One of the things that will be happening is most of these recommendations at some point will become before our commission as we're going forward. So I want to make sure everyone had initially an overview of what's going on, what's going to be coming before us as we move down the road. At this point in time, does anyone have any further questions that they'd like to ask at this point? Well, hearing none, Mr. Stark, I want to say thank you for the opportunity for you being here today. You've got us caught up, and with that, we will adjourn at this point in time. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.